We're here opposing the proposed regional waste transfer station on 9th Street. Are you with me?
Yeah!
All right, okay.
Well, I think anyone that's concerned for the health of their family, their own health, particularly for children in this area, this project is within 1 mile of 9 schools, half a mile from the school that we're standing at today, Washington Elementary, that they need to stand up and speak about it now, because once it's in, it's very hard to reverse a project like that.
See or no? Yes or no?
Just 5 miles south of the luxurious Claremont Colleges, a devoted group of parents, teachers, and families are working together to resist the construction of a waste transfer station in one of the poorest places in Pomona, California. I spoke with Emily Elrod Black, a student at Scripps College who researched the protest and the problems.
Well, my name is Emily Elrod Black, and I'm a sophomore at Scripps. There is a proposal by a company called Valley Vista for a waste transfer site. A waste transfer station is a place where trash goes from being picked up to transferred to another company in their trucks where they take it off to a landfill. There's already a waste transfer station in Pomona, and that handles all of Pomona's trash, but there's a new site being proposed to bring in trash from all of the surrounding areas, which the community members of Pomona are very unhappy about.
Justice is
because
really
the air quality,
the fact
and
that
the
all people,
the air
no matter
race,
terrible,
economic status, location, whatever, should have equal rights to live, work, and learn in environments that are healthy and safe. And what's going on in Pomona, and the situation that is already there, in addition to the waste transfer station, is going to make their environment increasingly unhealthy for their lives. And this is something that all people should have access to, and they don't, and that's unfair, and they don't have control over this. So that's why they're trying to fight back and say, we should have a right to play a part in our environment. We should care because these are fellow human beings, and they are suffering.
Nearly 18% of the population in Pomona lives below the poverty line, and of the surrounding cities that the waste transfer station is supposed to serve, Pomona is by far the poorest. So why are Pomona residents the one bearing the brunt of the environmental impact? This is just one example of a myriad of instances of environmental injustice that occur all over the globe. I'm Summer Dad Lukesh, and welcome to Uproot. Today, we ask, what is environmental justice, and how does it affect people in the United States and around the world? Join me and a number of environmental justice experts as we explore this complicated issue, making sense of the way the environment impacts people and what we can do about it. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency defines environmental justice as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. It will be achieved when everyone enjoys the same degree of protection from environmental and health hazards and equal access to the decision-making process to have a healthy environment in which to live, learn, and work. The father of environmental justice, Dr. Robert Bullard, says that what the environmental justice movement is about is trying to address all of the inequities that result from human settlement, industrial facility siting, and industrial development. That might sound like a mouthful, so an easier way to think about environmental justice is that human beings have a fundamental human right to clean air, land, water, and food, regardless of their race or how much money they have. In October of 1991, delegates to the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit drafted and adopted a list of 17 principles of environmental justice. They include the right of all workers to a safe and healthy work environment without being forced to choose between an unsafe livelihood and employment. It also affirms the right of those who work at home to be free from environmental hazards. Environmental justice affirms the need for urban and rural ecological policies to clean up and rebuild cities and rural areas in balance with nature, honoring the cultural integrity of all communities and providing fair access for all to a full range of resources. To me, the most striking phrase on the list is the right to be free from ecological destruction. All of this sounds fancy, but what it really means is that a lot of the time, communities of color or communities that are poor end up shouldering the burden of environmental hazards. These include the hazard of living next to a freeway and breathing in car pollution all day, the hazards of working on a farm where big farming corporations use toxic chemicals as pesticides in order to make a bigger profit, or living in a slum where toxic waste exists in and around residential areas. And most of the time, these communities that suffer from their environmental hazards didn't create the hazards in the first place. It's not poor families living on a major street who are driving big rig trucks to a port so they can pull a profit. And it's not laborers who work in a field picking strawberries who get to build a huge house with the money they've made. The people who profit from hurting the environment and the people who suffer after it's hurt are in two very different situations. Environmental justice understands that some people are provided with the opportunity to choose to live in healthy environments, and that other people are forced to live in unhealthy ones, and that the difference between them is essentially unfair. So let's take a look at some of the environmental injustices occurring around the world, what they mean for people who are exposed to them, how people are addressing them, and what we can do to help. Let's start big. I mean really big. Let's take a look at the entire world and pick out some of the environmental justice problems that plague it and the people who live here. David Pello is a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department and Director of California Cultures and Comparative Perspective at the University of California, San Diego. He wrote a book called Resisting Global Toxics that explores the export of hazardous waste to poor communities and communities of color around the world, and examines methods of resistance organized by environmental justice groups. One of the biggest issues that plagues the global community is the illegal trade of electronic waste. In Arc Bobloshi, a suburb in Ghana outside of the capital, children play soccer among the smoke coming from burning e-waste, in barren fields full of old computers, cell phones, and printers. Every year, hundreds of millions of tons of the West's e-waste are dumped in digital dumping grounds like this. 15% of the world's e-waste is dumped and burned in Arc Bobloshi, where extremely toxic chemicals like lead, brominated flame retardants, mercury, and beryllium are released into the air. When the e-waste is burned and the smoke enters the air, it goes on to enter the lungs of children and young men who mine the fields of waste for salvageable parts to sell. The health impacts are staggering, as the toxic metals enter bodies and start to build up over time. Dr. David Pello explains, "Those of us in the global north produce more waste than the rest of the world, and we have become more sophisticated in our efforts to encourage other communities and nations to host and manage our waste for us." Basically, he's saying that people here in the United States, as well as countries in Europe, produce a lot of trash, and rather than take care of it ourselves, we send it to places like Arc Bobloshi, where it poisons children and destroys communities. So, environmental justice issues don't just affect communities across the ocean, full of people that we'll never meet. They impact people right here in the United States as well. Plastic problems in the United States are important, but they aren't the whole story. Another serious problem for communities in the United States is the proximity of freeways and major roads, including the cars that drive on them and the pollution that they produce, to families and children.
My name is Isela Ramirez. I'm the co-executive director with East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice. We're a community-based organization located in the city of Commerce, which is about 5 miles southeast of downtown LA. We work to promote a healthy and safe environment in communities that are disproportionately impacted by the negative health impacts of industrial pollution. Primarily, we organize in the communities of Commerce, East LA, and Long Beach.
East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice was established as a community group in 2001 by residents of the Commerce and East Los Angeles areas who were concerned with the increasing health and environmental impacts of industrial pollution in their community. They were also concerned about the pending expansion of projects adjacent to homes, schools, and parks. They worked to alleviate environmental injustice here in Southern California and in the Los Angeles and Long Beach areas specifically. Here's Isela explaining a little more about what she does and why she does it.
So the work of East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice to secure environmental justice really is about making sure that communities located anywhere really are in the forefront of decision making in terms of what their community will look like. So trying to accomplish environmental justice really is about making sure that there is an equal distribution of environmental hazards and benefits in the society as a general, but really focusing on communities that neighbor heavy industrial activity. The city of Comrades is a small community. It's about 6.6 square miles, and it's located about 5 miles southeast of downtown L.A. Was funded in 1960, and since then has been a very industrial city. About 60% of the land use is actually zoned as an industrial land, and there's a large, you know, I think about 40,000 people come to work every day in comparison to, you know, the 13,000 people that live there. And so there's a lot of really, you know, there's a lot of good movement activities. You know, the city of Commerce really sits in the intersection of the 5 and 710 freeways. The 710 freeway is, you know, a strip of 20 miles that really connects the Long Beach and Los Angeles port complex to the rail yards located in the city of Commerce and partially in the city of Vernon and East L.A. There are 4 rail yards in the city of Commerce. 2 of them are the largest in the region, and one in particular is the largest intermodal rail yard facility of its kind in the entire world, and that's the Hobart Yard that belongs to BNSF, or Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. What happens at these rail yards, or these intermodal rail yards, is that trucks coming from the ports are delivering containers filled with iPhones to, you know, grapes, to spices, anything that really Americans consume. And these containers then are, they change their mode of transportation, and that's why they're called intermodal facilities. And then they get loaded on a train, and then these trains can, you know, be as long as 3 miles long or a mile long. Sometimes they're double-deckered, so you have double the amount of containers stacked up. And then they are released, and they go eastward through the Southwest. And, you know, a lot of them end up in Chicago, where there is another mega kind of city of rail lines and railways. And a lot of the products that, you know, first arrive at the ports here and are passed by my community in the city of Commerce in the rail yards end up as far as New Jersey, you know, Nebraska, and really all over the U.S. Additionally, the city of Commerce is really a toxic soup. There's a lot of heavy industry that happens, from chrome plating facilities to lead battery manufacturing facilities to, you know, fungicide and pesticide manufacturing facilities, chemical storage facilities. We're nearby the city of Vernon, which is, you know, I think their motto is solely industrial, and so they really have a large variety of heavy industry. And while a lot of these companies are in compliance, what decision makers, right, the local air quality agencies, do not consider is the cumulative impact effects. And so when we say cumulative impact, we're talking about the pile-up effects. You know, if you consider one single community and you have a rail yard and a freeway and a chrome plating facility and a, you know, power plant or an incinerator, a trash burning power plant, and all these different small out-of-body shops and gas filling stations and, you know, dry cleaning facilities, all in the same community, then that same community is, you know, has an impact because they're exposed to diesel exhaust, they're exposed to lead, they're exposed to TCE, they're exposed to all these different toxins that are coming out of all these facilities. And so Eastyard really is trying to come up with a cumulative impact approach that would, you know, reduce the amount of existing or any, reduce the amount of any potentially new toxins from coming in. So we have a couple of campaigns to address that. Eastyard Communities organizes workshops and trainings to really facilitate the development of leaders within communities of color, poor communities of color, where community members, you know, our goal is to develop community members and to self-equip self-advocates, right? ideally, we would like community members to really take a sustainable and wholesome approach into decision-making processes, whether it's bringing in a new facility into the community or trying to adopt a new ordinance or a state regulation that is health protective and that really puts community and public health on the forefront of all decision-making. We feel that using workshops to provide the necessary tools for community members to really be, you know, equipped in being able to make good recommendations and highlight big, you know, problems with existing, you know, rail yard or freeway or whatever other types of proposals in their community to decision makers. Essentially, we want decision makers to be influenced by the community members that they're supposed to be representing. And for that to be possible, community members need to be educated on the issue and need to be confident about how to express not only their concerns, but also how to make good recommendations. Because at the end of the day, the community members that live in a community really are the experts of that community. They might not know the numbers or the science, but they have the lived experience that really is great education already. But when you pair their lived experience with the actual science and the actual data that we, you know, are able to distribute in these workshops, then you have a community leader that not only has a passion for community health in their own community, but is also, you know, armed with the right tools to be able to influence good decision-making.
East Yard Communities is one of many environmental justice organizations in the LA area. Yet another successful environmental justice organization is Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. Here's David Robinson, who directs the program United Neighbors in Defense Against Displacement with SAGE. Here he is talking about SAGE and his work.
SAGE's mission is to change public and corporate policy in a manner that provides concrete economic benefits to working class people, to increase the economic rights of working class people, and to build leadership through a movement for economic justice. And what that translates into is working on a number of issues, especially related to housing, especially tenant slum housing and tenants' rights,
mm-hmm.
Also working on land use and planning, increasing local low-income communities of color, increasing their voice in the planning and development happening in their neighborhoods, and also working especially on jobs and economic development and trying to increase the number of and availability of good jobs for people in their own community. And all those together are attempts to increase the essentially the self-determination and the power of working class people to you know, determine the direction individually of their lives, but also of their communities. One project that SAGE is working on right now is a campaign. We're part of a coalition called UNIDAD, which stands for United Neighbors in Defense Against Displacement.
Mm-hmm.
And the UNIDAD coalition, with SAGE as one of the founding members and the convener, is engaged in a campaign to respond to the expansion of the University of Southern California. The University of Southern California has got a 20-year master plan to expand, and in order to do that expansion, they need a city-specific plan. It's being called the USC-specific plan, which would be a legal planning document that will have all the details of what they're allowed to do in their expansion. And we are working very hard to partner with USC and with the city to ensure that USC's expansion happens in a way that enables not just USC and its community to thrive, but also the local community to thrive.
SAGE also educates people who live in and around Los Angeles about the history of the LA area and environmental justice issues that occur there.
It's often not known today, but Los Angeles pioneered something called that's now called racial zoning, where it was actually written into law who could live in which areas of the city based on people's race. And this was overturned by the Supreme Court, but there was, from very early in the 20th century, most of the city, in terms of where residents could be, was off limits to African Americans, to Mexican Americans, to a number of other racial groups, to Chinese Americans. So, and we had, this was still from the, in the 19th century, L.A. was a very diverse city because workers kept being brought in for, especially for the railroads. So you had Chinese and Japanese and Mexican. You had already, you had had Native American, but they had been pushed out rather early. And you had, I don't know if I mentioned African American. Anyway, so we had a number of groups, and they were not allowed to live in most of the city. And even when that was outlawed by the Supreme Court, racial zoning was outlawed, what ended up happening is that in the covenants, the deeds for properties, racial segregation got written right into those deeds. So certain areas of the city became the place, the only places where racial minorities could live, and particularly South L.A. was one of the very few places where African Americans were allowed to live. So this became a part of the city that was predominantly African American, but to begin with was extremely overcrowded because people weren't allowed to live in other parts of the city. This also became the area then where freeways later in the mid-20th century were put through. This became the area, one of the areas where residential areas got rezoned industrial. So as I mentioned a little earlier, factories got suddenly put down in residential neighborhoods next to homes, next to schools. And it also included much of the oldest housing stock in the city, and often owned by this point by absentee landlords. So the housing stock deteriorated, and the very houses people were living in became essentially contaminated environments with lead paint, you know, on the walls, and that's extremely dangerous. You know, it's a poison and causes brain damage in children. Brain damage in children and lots of other things. Mm-hmm. And, of course, lots of vermin, mold, a whole bunch of things that, that cause really significant negative health impacts. So South L.A. for, and then at the same time, if you add the fact that this area was redlined, meaning that banks and insurance companies and others wouldn't invest in this area, wouldn't offer mortgages, wouldn't offer loans, wouldn't, it became an area that was made poor, not an area that just became poor, but was made poor by both public and private policy. The area where Sage works is the asthma epicenter of L.A., especially childhood asthma, but there are, you know, numerous ill health effects that have been documented having to do with pollution from, you know, from cars and especially from living near freeways. So you get many, many determinants of ill health concentrated here in the environment where people are living. And if you add in finally that this is a medically underserved area where there are far fewer hospitals and clinics than in most other parts of the city, it all adds up to an extremely unhealthy environment for people to be living in.
So we know now that environmental injustices can occur on faraway continents, in unseen communities, or right here in our backyard. In any case, talking about all the environmental injustices that occur to millions of people all over the world can be overwhelming and hard to grasp. When the issue is so big, how do we tackle it in a way that is productive and empowering? Those are the sounds of the South Bronx, a part of New York City that suffers from extreme pollution and environmental degradation. The Bronx holds 40% of New York City's waste, including its own. Sewage treatment and electrical power plants coexist with 60,000 diesel trucks that drive through the borough every year, pumping toxins into the air of neighborhoods with families and children. The Bronx is a very real and very serious example of environmental injustice, but it's also a great example of environmental justice solutions. Majora Carter is an environmental justice advocate who founded Sustainable South Bronx. Her organization is a community-initiated nonprofit group that works to educate people who live in the Bronx about their impact on the environment and the environment's impact on them. Carter and her organization are successful not only because of her powerful and persuasive public speaking skills, but because she mobilizes within her community rather than importing experts from outside to prescribe solutions to environmental problems. Majora Carter and her work in the South Bronx are impressive and important contributions to the environmental justice community. Carter and Sustainable South Bronx spurred the development of the South Bronx Greenway, 11 miles of green space inside and along the waterfronts within the South Bronx, providing a safe and clean outdoor space to socialize, exercise, and get around. The community also started the Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training, or BEST, Academy, to equip local workers with the skills to participate directly in the kind of cleanup and energy-efficient renovations that are being discussed citywide, nationwide, and globally. BEST Academy has generated a team of greenway stewards and green roof installers who have planted more than 400 trees in the neighborhood and constructed several of the city's first green roofs. Since 2003, BEST Academy has trained over 300 people who have gone on to help repair and reverse the community's environmental problems. Their model green collar training program shows that it is possible to simultaneously address both economic hardship and the environmental health of marginalized communities. Here in California, we also have a number of successful and committed environmental justice organizations. One of them is Communities for a Better Environment, also known as CBE.
Okay. My name is Mark Lopez. I live in East LA, and I'm a youth organizer with Communities for a Better Environment in Huntington Park and Southgate.
Mark works for CBE in East Los Angeles, where as recently as 2009, members stopped the construction of a 943-megawatt fossil fuel power plant in their immediate community. The power plant would have emitted 1.7 million pounds of toxic pollution per year, as well as 2.8 million tons of greenhouse gases. Here's Mark talking a little more about what they do.
Communities for a Better Environment is an organization that works in and with communities of color, especially low-income communities, to combat the effects of environmental racism. And so here in Southeast Los Angeles, in Huntington Park specifically, CBE came into the mix with the with a campaign to remove a concrete mountain where basically they were recycling the concrete, they were grinding it up, but not in a very safe way. And so that was causing a lot of health issues in the immediate area. So people in that community started getting informed, started organizing, and organizing with Communities for a Better Environment. And that campaign lasted a while, but eventually got cleaned up. And so I think that made the organization very strong here, even though it was the first campaign, it made it very strong because that was a huge victory for the community. And so the way we were able to accomplish that was through the community power, the community activism, the community organizing, but also with research and scientists that work for CBE that were able to support with some of the technical work, and then also lawyers that work for CBE that were able to kind of come in a legal angle on that work. And so that's the way CBE has kind of moved forward with its work since then here in Southeast LA. I think some of the more memorable campaigns since then include a power plant in Southgate that was proposed to be built, which was fought back, and then even more recently, a power plant in the city of Vernon, just down the street from Huntington Park High School, which was fought back again. A lot of it through a lot of especially youth leadership within the schools. There was a lot of strong organizing coming out, and then the adults that organized with CBE, as well as our researchers and scientists and our lawyers, that kind of the three, what would you call that? I guess like a triad approach, mm-hmm. to basically trying to get justice in our communities. And so we're pretty effective in that manner. And I think sometimes, you know, certain projects are initiated by our community members. They see something going on, or they hear of something going on, and we go forward with that. And sometimes, you know, people from outside of the community inform us of different proposed projects coming into our community. And so then we inform our community members and engage their interest in that, and then we move forward from there. So even more recently, within the last week, actually, there's a metal recycler here in the community that some community members have approached the organization about wanting to get them to clean up. There's a lot of the same issues with La Montaña, which was that concrete mountain, are the same ones they're having there. A lot of noise, a lot of odors, a lot of dust. And it's really close to, it's across the street from a lot of housing, adjacent to some housing, very close to schools. And so they're interested in wanting to get them to clean up. So that's something we're starting to initiate. So those new community members who have approached us now have been involved in the conversation with our current members, some of whom live in that immediate area. So right now we're starting to see a campaign emerge organically from the community. And so I'm really excited for that and try to see how that moves forward and already seeing how our triad model is kind of being utilized for this. I think the most effective thing about the organizing for CBE is being able to connect personally with community members. I think that's what touches a lot of people to get really actively involved in the movement. So a lot of us being able to share our personal stories, the community members here relate to the personal stories. I myself am from East LA, which is just on the other side of the industrial cities of Vernon and Commerce from Huntington Park. And so a lot of the same issues that I deal with there in East LA is the same stuff that's going on down here in Huntington Park. And so I think being able to relate in that way, being able to communicate personal stories of issues, but then also of empowerment. And I think that's what really works to get people motivated to do something about it. And I think especially because Communities for a Better Environment has been so successful here in the community of Huntington Park and Southgate, that we can talk really, really well about the problems, but we can also talk about our victories. And so that motivates people to really feel like change can happen.
Mark does most of his work with youth, young high school students who live in affected areas and who care a lot about their families and communities. Many of us are lucky enough to live in areas where environmental injustice isn't as much of a problem, but that doesn't mean that we don't care or that we don't want to get involved. I asked the community organizers I spoke with how students can get involved in the fight against environmental racism and environmental injustice.
Students everywhere really need to do some research, right? That's what we all go to school for, is to learn how to become researchers and be able to translate research into, you know, for students, a lot of the times it's papers. But I think that there's a lot of nonprofit or community organizations anywhere, really across the U.S. and everywhere, where you have low resources and a lot of work. I just gave you an example in the city of Commerce. I mean, there is every kind of, you know, environmental issue. And so having the support of college students, whether it's through an internship or through some volunteer hours, whether it's, you know, by helping to make phone calls, to entering data on an Excel sheet, you know, to leading chants in an action, or helping to drive students, other students, or other community members to public meetings, anything and everything will help the movement. You know, I think the environmental justice movement is not very well funded, right? We have to do a lot with a little bit. And so any help and any expertise, any interest that a student may have in their academic career can be translated into direct action.
I think students have a really unique position, as a lot of students don't actually come from the communities that they're going to school in at a university. So, for example, Claremont College, I think a lot of people come from different parts of California or different parts of the U.S. and even internationally, right? And so I think universities can feel like a bubble at times, because you don't know how to connect into the immediate communities surrounding. But I think specifically in Claremont, you have areas that are really close, like Pomona or like Riverside, where there's already community struggles that have existed for a while there. that students can readily be plugged into. Students offer a great deal of passion, a great deal of idealism, and a lot of energy into the work. I think specifically with youth organizing, for students to see, for high school students to see university students active and engaged in the work that they're doing, and that's also a motivating factor.
I think that in the end, what is most moving about the work that advocates are doing and environmental justice in general is the stories, the realities of people who live far away or right next door. There are a lot of people who are really passionate about environmental justice, so much so that they dedicate their lives to this movement. That passion comes from a lot of places, but I think one of the most important is personal experience and a collective history shared by people who are poor as well as communities of color. So what can we take away from this? How can we react? We know a little more about what environmental justice is, why it matters, and what we can do about it. All I can ask now is that all of our listeners consider taking a look at the communities that they live in and the way that those work. How do your actions affect the people around you, or even the people who live across the world? We're all human beings, and we all deserve respect and health, and when our addiction to fossil fuels or our aversion to trash starts to affect the most powerless in our country and our world, that's a problem. At the beginning of this segment, we referenced the principles of environmental justice. I'd like to end with a reference to one of those principles, number 17. It reads as follows. Environmental justice requires that we, as individuals, make personal and consumer choices to consume as little of Mother Earth's resources and to produce as little waste as possible, and make the conscious decision to challenge and reprioritize our lifestyles to ensure the health of the natural world for present and future generations. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this segment. Once again, I'm Summer Dowd Lukesh, and you're listening to Uproot. To learn more about environmental injustice and how you can get involved, consider checking out one of the following organizations. Strategic Actions for a Just Economy does work in South LA and can be found at www.saje.net. Communities for a Better Environment works for environmental justice all over the state of California. Check them out at www.cbecal.org. East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice works in East LA. Their website is eycej.org. Finally, to learn more about the tenets and history of environmental justice, you can check out www.ejnet.org/ej, where you can find a variety of resources, including a full list of the principles of environmental justice. Recommended reading includes Dumping in Dixie by Dr. Robert D. Bullard and Resisting Global Toxics, Transnational Movements for Environmental Justice by Dr. David Pella.